surgeon said. "Can some be fetched?" "There is a bit of hasty pudding left over in the galley," Kavanagh said. "I do know that because I've seen it."
"I've seen it too." This came fervently from the boy Charlie, who was always hungry. "They like dried peas boiled in a cloth," Sullivan said. "All the black races is infatuated on that dish."
"God damn me," Blair said, instantly furious. "We might have known you'd put your clappers in. Are you going to tell us—"
"It would take too long to get it ready," Barris said, "and the hasty pudding is made with oatmeal, which you will not be used to." He looked at their faces, struck by a sense of the mystery of things. This man had been taken from his home and tortured, and brought to the edge of death, too close to be brought back, he suspected, and now these other men, who had assisted in it, were eager to find some way of tempting his appetite. He was aware of Thurso, up on the quarter-deck, ostensibly withdrawn from the proceedings, but able to hear every word that was uttered. Is it concern for the negro they are expressing, or support for me? The question sprang to his mind, and he surprised in himself a feeling of mingled exhilaration and reluctance. And I? Which do I care for more, this man's life, or proving right? He had not thought this question could come at him again. He had thought it dealt with, disposed of, forever. He looked down at the negro, as if to find an answer there. The man's thumbs were covered with blood, and he could not understand this until he realized that the pressure of the thumb screws had caused him to bleed through the nails.
"No, we will try with rice," he repeated in his deep, vibrant voice. "Here it is now. Thank you, Charlie," he said to the boy, who had come at a run with a dish of rice and a wooden spoon. "Where is the linguista?"
Jimmy came forward.
"I don't know if he understand me," he said. "Maybe understand Malinka."
Paris drew closer to the man and crouched down beside him as he half sat, half lay against the foot of the steps.
"Tell him I want him to eat this rice," he said.
He felt suddenly helpless and ridiculous. How could he persuade the man to eat?
"Tell him I want him to live," he said to Jimmy urgently and impatiently.
Jimmy squatted and spoke close to the man's ear.
"I'll take a wee bit," McGann said. "I'll gi' you 10 to 1. 5 shillings to sixpence, the doctor will no get a crumb doing his gullet."
"A penny to a shilling, he gets summat in," Wilson said.
"Aye, in his mouth," Libby said. "That's easy, man. That's not what McGann is laying odds on. His mouth is open already. No, he's got a swaller to win the bet."
The negro showed no sign of hearing. His eyes looked at nothing. His head hung down at an awkward angle.
"I think this man going," Jimmy said. "This man finish. I try him pigeon."
He brought his mouth close to the man's ear again.
"Dis buckra man, doctor. Say you nyam-nyam. Say you nyam and drinky kaba. Everything fine-fine."
Paris freighted the spoon with rice, then put it back down on the plate again. He saw now that the spoon was too big. He took some of the moist and sticky rice between his thumb and first two fingers and extended this towards the man. He was aware of the silence among the people looking on. Some of the women slaves had joined the circle of seamen. There was a ring round him, cutting off the air. The stench of captivity came to him. From the man before him, the spectators, white and black, the massed bodies of the slaves under the awning.
"Eat," he said. "I want you to eat."
He could read no expression on the broad, flat-boned face, unless the approach of death can be an expression. The eyes were fixed on the strip of plank between his long and narrow feet. The mouth hung open, a spongy ellipse, allowing the pale loll of the tongue to show within it. As Paris crouched there, holding out in his fingers the sticky ball of rice, he knew that he was alone with this man, that the two of them were quite alone. The pale sky had clutched at them, gathered them into privacy, into some area of seclusion. He did not know whose was the greater arrogance, his or this dying man's.
"Eat it,"
he said harshly. He reached forward and put the rice between the man's lips, feeling the helpless softness of the mouth as he did so, pushing the food between the barriers of the teeth. He dipped his fingers again into the dish, moulding a new ball. The man's mouth made no movement. His lips still hung slackly open, but as Paris again reached forward, the eyes for the first time looked at him, registered his presence there, directly, immediately. Paris saw in the eyes the desire for death,
and recognized it as his own familiar, but in these same eyes that longed for the burden of pain to be removed, there was what the surgeon had seen in his own looking-glass while the bread dissolved in his mouth. Inveterate, unquenchable, the hope of life, the appeal to be saved, and Paris knew in that same moment that he had done a wicked thing to sail with this ship out of mere despair. "Eat it," he said again. He saw a blaze in the man's eyes, saw the mouth work to gather its contents. The negro raised himself a little, and his face strained forward with a curiously patient effort. With a deep gasp, almost a groan, the mouth opened and sprayed out its contents. Paris felt the warm shock of the rice and spit on his face, and saw the negro's head fall back against the ladder and his eyes turn upward. Haines took a step forward, half raising his whip.
"Let me have a go with this," he said. "I'll teach him spittin'."
Paris got to his feet. "Stand clear of him," he said. "Stand back from him." There was an eagerness on Haines's face. On an impulse he did not understand, Paris took a step towards the boatswain and thrust at him violently. The power in his arms was a revelation, perhaps most of all to the surgeon himself. Haines was a big man and well planted on his feet, but he was sent staggering back. Paris took out a handkerchief and wiped his face slowly.
"There was not much gained by flogging him, even when he was alive," he said,
loudly enough for the captain and mate on the quarter-deck to hear. He glanced across the deck at the shackled men under the awning. They avoided his eye, as usual, except for one tall and strongly built man, whom he recognized now as the first slave he had examined. This man was looking at him steadily, though without discernible expression, and he did not look away when their eyes met. An unusual thing. Chapter 30. The dead slave was thrown overboard at once. He was followed 2 days later by a woman who, though eating her portions without protest, had been in a state of deepening lethargy for some time, and was found dead on deck in the early morning, with no sign about her as to the cause. Then the ship's boy, Charlie, began to sicken with the same symptoms that Simmons had shown. As his fever mounted, the hammering and clatter on the ship mounted with it. Under the supervision of Johnson, the gunner, the men were sheathing the foreparts of the mainmast and a space of the deck forward of it with lead plate, so that the furnace could be placed amidship with more security, there being more mouths aboard now than the ship's iron pot could boil for. Charlie, whose surname nobody knew, who had experienced little but blows and hunger in his 14 years, died, shivering and vomiting, not knowing whether these heavy detonations of sound were within him or without. Paris could fathom neither the one death nor the other. Charlie had not berthed in any proximity to the second mate. He had not gone on the expedition to Tucker's, and so had not been exposed to any poisonous airs from the river. Paris knew there were sexual relations among some of the men. Simmons, after contracting the disease, might have sodomized the boy and so communicated the contagion. From questions such as these, and from his own ignorance, he sought refuge where he could find it, in memories of the past, in attention to the daily trafficking for slaves that still continued. That steady look of the negro exercised his mind in the days that followed, though it was not repeated. It was the first time he had actually been regarded by any of these people. He could not decide if it had been a look of enmity or recognition of something. "It was as if," he wrote in his journal, "the life of the eyes was transferred from the man who spat at me, who died, transferred from him to the other." Fanciful, no doubt, he thought, sitting late in his cramped cabin, unable to sleep for all the cradling motion of the ship. He felt that he was changed. He had become prey to superstitious fancies, as he had to impulses of violence.
"Close weather lately, with lightnings and variable winds. The slaves have had to be kept under hatches a good part of the time. Barber has fitted the platforms and bulkheads now. Tapley is in irons up against the windlass, and has been so since yesterday. It seems that he seduced one of the women to go with him below, and there lay with her, brute-like, in view of those of his companions not on deck.
It was not a rape, all are agreed, so he may escape flogging. He is a sly, rat-like man, Tapley. At daybreak there came several canoes alongside us with traders to offer their services. They were sent back ashore by Captain Thurzo to purchase slaves and rice, he having provided them on trust with trade goods. One came back within 2 hours with a man and 2 girls, bringing our number to 83. There is, in the offing now, as well as the Frenchman and a Danish slaver newly arrived, a London ship, the Astrid, Captain Coburn. In mid-morning, Thurzo went over to her in the punt, having been told she had 8 slaves aboard to change for ivory. He returned shortly with that clamp-jawed, staring look of his when he's in a rage. It seems he could not take the slaves on Coburn's terms, which was 60 bars per head round. According to Barton, there were but 3 of the slaves sizable, and 2 of the remaining 5 under 3 foot 6 inches. 60 bars for dwarfs now, Barton said, and laughed, though not so Thurzo would hear. Barton keeps me informed, though not out of friendship. I do not believe he has feelings for anyone. It may be that he thinks to ingratiate himself for the sake of my uncle, but I believe he enjoys using some tone of disrespect to compensate for his usual sycophancy. Trade is slowing down. The local dealers will very seldom bring a slave to the ship to sell, and the boat trade is dearer and more precarious. As a consequence, whenever any do bring a slave, Thurzo is obliged to accept him, being in fear that if he refuses, he will not get the chance of another. Meanwhile, the French are rumoured to be paying 80 bars for an adult male. "The crappos are trying to ruin us," Barton said. I do not know whom he means by us. The ruin has been total for some aboard this ship already. I suspect we shall be leaving here soon, and proceeding further along the coast to eastward, now that trade is slackening. We have lost 2 slaves, and several more look very listless and low, and will scarce move except they are whipped, though I cannot determine any disease in them. It is as if they cannot emerge from the shock of their capture. Sometimes, in storm weather, the shore had fluttered with disabled swallows. They crouched lower for his approach, without strength to escape. In his hands they pulsed with that same pulse. He had taken a bird and warmed it between his hands, or inside his jacket, brought the life back until it was able to fly. Sometimes, released from his hands, they circled once around him before flying away, in gratitude, or so the child had believed, and the belief had survived all the man's science. It was Wilson who had come upon the dead woman. He told the story at the time favoured for stories, in the first of the twilight, before the night watch was set, when it was still early enough for most men to be on deck. The captain was making his usual walk on the weather side of the quarter-deck, 12 paces forward, 12 back. Barton stood alone on the lee side, and Johnson was at the weather gangway, mending a tear in his jacket by the lamp there. Haines, having seen to the coiling of the ropes, was smoking a pipe with Morgan in the galley. 2 of those on half-watch, Hughes and True, were amidships, guarding the slaves. The others were lying on the forecastle, smoking, talking together. It was a relaxed time on the ship, a time for speculation and hyperbole.
"She were crawled right under the gangway," Wilson said. "Behind the gangway ladder, up again the side. Hardly space for a cat in there. She were crawled under among some bread-butts."
He had been sent forward with Callie shortly after turning to that morning to wash down the deck, and had found her there, in the first light of the day, lying on her side, knees drawn up, in the narrow space between the butts.
"Not a mark on her," Wilson said. "She must have been took sick and crawled in there."
There were things about this discovery that Wilson did not speak of to the others. He had thought her asleep. Her back was to him, and in the carelessness of her condition the waistcloth had ridden up over her buttocks to show the brand mark high on the left one. Callie was over on the other side of the deck. There was no one else near. Moving the butts clear, he felt half suffocated with eagerness. By good luck, as he thought, she did not wake. It was his idea to take her from behind while she was still too sleepy to make effective resistance. He had lowered himself against her and had a hand over her mouth before he felt the chill of the body and realized that he was jammed up against a corpse.
"Shark meat," he said now, with resentment.
Wilson never forgot an injury, and this death seemed one to him, cheating his lust. Light from the forecastle lamps glinted on his dark stubble as he turned his face slowly from side to side.
"That's all she were. Shark meat."
"I never seen her," Callie said. "I was on the other side. I seen her, but I didn't find her. Wilson shouted to me to come and look at this."
He wished he could have been the one to find her and have something to tell.
"You couldn't find your own cock in the dark," Libby said.
The dead jelly of his eye emitted a thin, satiric gleam.
"You lost yourself, didn't you? And had to be brought back by the Corshees."
A rare moment of felicity came to Callie.
"Well, I got two eyes," he said, "so I got more chance of finding things than what you have."
This unexpected riposte set Blair chuckling.
"That's sweet, lad. You had twice the chance of some," he said.
And this support, and the fact that Blair had laughed at his joke, secured him Callie's affection forever.
"They dies of melancholy," Barber said, round the stem of his pipe. "I have seen it over and over. They sets their minds on dying. I've been on ships where it spread like a plague. You put 'em below, just as usual, two by two, and they looks just the same as ever, and in the morning you find a dead and a living man chained together, and that is the first you notice any difference between them."
"When one dies, others will follow,"
Sullivan said, glancing about him as if disturbed in a dream.
"It was Simmons set it loose, God rest his soul. Death has sailed with every ship that ever put out of port. Once he gets loose, there is no confining him again."
"He's the only free fuckster on this ship, then," Wilson said, "except for the captain." "It is true that a curse will sometimes fasten on a ship," Davis said. "There was the Black Prince, Captain Biddy, which I sailed with in 44. We were trading on the Gambia, and the captain was a Tartar. This one's a saint to him. He would flog a man every day for one reason or another. And I seen him drown a black woman in a swill tub with his own hands for trying to pass a marlin spike to one of the men slaves. I tell you, he was a devil. He'd given out arms and ammunition to the natives ashore so they could make a war party to take slaves, and in exchange he'd taken 8 men aboard as pawns." "What is that?" Blair asked. "They're relatives of the chief, or people belonging to the chief, that offers themselves for it, on the agreement that unless slaves are furnished within a certain time, or goods to the value of what has been loaned, the pawns will be carried off instead. Our agreement was for 3 days. But Biddy did not wait the due time. He took advantage of a favourable wind to up anchor and make off. The result was that another ship was attacked by the natives in revenge. The Molly it was, for no other reason than she was a Liverpool ship. She wasn't a slaver even. She was trading for beeswax and pepper. The captain and the mate and 5 crew were taken and tied to trees and had their throats cut. The English sent a sloop from Goree with a platoon of troops and a cannon to punish the blacks for this outrage, and they burned their village over their heads and killed several of them, and one of the soldiers was killed in the fighting. Now all this blood was on Captain Biddy's head, as he had broke the bond, but there was a curse on that ship from the moment of leaving. Biddy lost 2/3 of his negroes by the bloody flux on the Middle Passage, including all but one of the pawns he had taken, and so it was paid back to him."
"Paid back to him," Blair said.
"What became of Biddy then?"
"He retired shortly after. He had put savings by. He went to live in Kent with his unmarried daughter. He was a Kentish man, do you see, Captain Biddy."
"I have seen blindness spread on a ship," Wilson said. "There is a skin grows over the eyes. Thou wakes up in the morning and thou canna see out. The negroes come aboard with it already about them, and it gets among the crew. I were on a ship once, when everyone were going blind with it, skipper and all. We were out in the Gulf of Guinea when it started, bound for Barbados, but we had to put back to San Tome. I were talking to the bosun, name of Billy Fox, talking away 1 minute. Next he says, 'Christ, give us a fin, mate. Me eyes have gone.'"
"Did he get better?" Callie, whose sleep would be troubled, had been following this story with round eyes.
"Get better? He didn't have no chance to get better. Billy couldn't keep off the women. He went to a crack house back in Saint-Thomé and fell down some steps and broke his neck. There were a canary on board, and that went blind as well. As soon as it went blind, it started singing. It were dumb before.
There was a pause at this. Wilson was an unpredictable man, and no one felt inclined to risk provoking him by seeming not to believe it. After some moments, Libby gave it out as his opinion that Africans were able to put an end to themselves by holding their breath, this being the only explanation for deaths among fed slaves with no injuries or marks of disease.
"A man cannot kill himself just by holding his breath,"
Blair said, with some beginnings of the confused anger he always showed at contradictory or illogical statements.
"If he holds his breath, he'll fall down in a faint, and when he falls down in a faint, he'll start breathing again. If you dinna believe me, try it for yourself."
"No use asking me to try it," Libby laughed and spat over the rail. "I'm an Englishman, aye?"
"An Englishman cannot do it," Tapley said. "Only these here blacks can do it. They are closer to animals than what we are."
"If they are closer than what you are, Tapley, they must be amazing creatures indeed," Blair said. "I agree with what Barber says. It is melancholy kills them."
"I will be dying of melancholy myself aboard of this ship," Sullivan said. "I am playing me fiddle for them blacks every morning, and the sound of the clanking they make is drowning out me notes. I am going to have a word with the captain about it."
"The only word you'll ever have with the captain is aye, aye, sir," Blair said.
"You said the same thing about me buttons, but I spoke up to Haines."
"Aye, and wha still got him? Speaking up to Thurzo is a different matter. You have only to look at him wrong, and it's bread and water in the bilboes."
"A man with justice on his side will always be listened to," Sullivan said.
"You're all gob, Sullivan," McGann said. "We might talk you more serious if you'd put money on it. Will you talk a bet in even shillings? My shilling says you'll never hear the brass to speak up to Thurzo."
"The Scotch were always doubters," Sullivan said. "My shilling says I'll speak to him, man to man. Billy? You are my witness."
Chapter 31. With the slaves' numbers now so much increased, the enforced periods below decks rendered their quarters noisome. It was Paris's duty to see the platforms well washed down, and the area between decks smoked for some hours to purify the air. Relations with the coast Negroes had worsened. The Frenchman's yawl had driven ashore at Little Bassa and had been smashed and plundered, and her crew roughly handled by the natives. The news had perturbed Thurzo, who was afraid that this success would encourage other attempts.
"These villains will copy any bad example," he observed to Barton, "but show them a good model of behaviour and they will sheer away from it as if it were the devil. They are inclined by nature to every kind of mischief and evil-doing."
The thought of losing the ship's boat worried him a great deal. There was no trade anywhere along the windward coast without a sloop of some sort.
"You can trade with them for 20 years, he said. "Then some other white man does them an injury, and they pretend to believe we're all tarred with the same brush."
"They're wrong there, Captain," Barton said. "It is them who have been tarred."
Thurzo regarded his first mate with a displeasure he took no trouble to conceal. He was an enemy to jokes, feeling an energy in them beyond his controlling.
"Barton, I do not like levity," he said. "You know my feelings, and still you go on with it. I advise you to be careful."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"We will be going on round the coast very soon, down to the company fort. We will do our private business for the gold dust there, upriver, as we did before. This voyage will be our last together. What course you set afterwards is no concern of mine, but while you are mate on my ship, you'll keep to my mood. I was remarking on the fickleness of these dogs, and their readiness to follow any bad example."
Then the yawl returned from 6 days trading upriver, with 8 slaves, a tusk weighing nearly 40 pounds, and 2 quintals of camwood, and with Johnson in the waist, half-conscious and shivering with fever, and True hardly able to stand to his oars. It was this that decided Thurzo. 2 of the crew were dead already, and 1 had run. Any more, and he could not keep the yawl manned and the negroes guarded at the same time, and so would not manage to bring off slaves anywhere on this side of the Cape. Next morning he sent ashore for water and more rice. They had more than 1,000 pounds of it aboard now. Later he sent Haines and 4 men with 20 fathoms of remnants to exchange for yams, plantains, and palm oil, but these supplies could not be brought aboard till next day, as there was so great a sea across the bar that Haines did not dare to venture over. When they came, they brought with them also a single slave, a well-grown boy of 14 or so, bringing the total number to 97, of which 30 were women. In the course of the day, the ship's sails were loosed and aired, and the spare sails brought up and overhauled. It was found that the rats had done some damage to these. The ship was by now overrun with them, as the three cats they had brought out from England were all dead, and they had been quite unable to find one ashore. Under Barton's supervision, Johnson being too ill, the small arms were discharged and reloaded. With nightfall, the slaves were herded to their quarters below, and the hatches fastened down in them. Thurzo knowing from old that to leave slaves on deck, men or women, when the ship was leaving their home shores, was to invite trouble of the most serious kind.
"I have seen it happen," he said that evening to Barton and Paris, whom he had invited to sup with him on this eve of departure. "They become desperate when they see the ship putting out to sea. They'll sometimes throw themselves over the side, chained as they are, and in their shackles, you see. They cannot long stay alive once they're in the water. They are gone under before you can lower a boat for 'em. I have known 'em shout and laugh with the joy of cheating us. It is a dead loss to the owners, since we are not underwritten for suicide."
They were sitting over brandy after the meal. Thurzo was in a more than usually expansive mood this evening, with his trading done here and half his cargo already purchased. Since hearing Paris's report, he was less troubled at the thought of being left undermanned. Johnson was still weak and complained of racking pains in head and limbs, but True's fever had left him. Both men had been drinking heavily and sleeping in native huts on shore. It was the surgeon's opinion that they had exposed themselves to malignant ground vapours and thus contracted marsh fever, though it seemed of an ephemeral kind.
"If the men have to sleep away from the ship," the surgeon said, "they should be sure to have a fire lit in their close vicinity, just sufficient to raise a gentle smoke. This would render the night airs less noxious."
"Aye, it is the same practice we use aboard ship," Barton said, "to clear the air between decks."
Thurzo looked from the mate to the surgeon. He could not suffer men to show any accord in his company without prior reference to himself.
"You may be right, Mr. Paris," he said, "but you'll never get any discipline or good governance from these men. They'll take no notice of advice that might tend to their good. Hard labour aboard, debauchery ashore, and an early grave. That is the way of it for nearly all of them."
Thurzo paused for a moment, looking closely at the surgeon, feeling the customary irritation of moral constraint the other put upon him by his silences as much as his words.
"We're living in the real world, Mr. Paris," he said. "We have to shape our course to the weather."
"The measure I'm suggesting is practical enough, sir," Paris said mildly. Thurzo raised a blunt forefinger and tapped slowly at the side of his head.
"It is in the mind," he said. "You've got to bring 'em to the right frame of mind, and when you have animals to deal with, it is done by fear, sir, not persuasion."
There had been a jibe contained in this, and Thurzo saw it register. The surgeon's face had lost the look of youth, but there was no concealment in it. What he felt changed the expression of his eyes and moved the corners of his mouth.
"Persuasion gets you a gobful of rice in the face," Barton said, with his lackey's instinct for pressing home the attacks of his master.
Paris smiled slightly, but he had felt his heart quicken.
"So you think the rice in the face was a victory for the method of fear, Barton, do you? I must say I find that a strange interpretation of the event." "Take the negroes," Thurzo said, with unmoved face. He often behaved as if no one had spoken since his own last remark. "This mortality by which we suffer such losses is entirely owing to their brooding so much on their situation. If you want to get them to market in good condition, you must change their way of thinking. I remember once, many years ago now, it was one of my first ships. We were trading in the Bight of Benin and had taken aboard a cargo of Igbo. I do not buy Igbo nowadays. They have a reputation for being unreliable and do not fetch prices anything comparable to the Windward Coast Negroes, though I know of skippers that deal in nothing else, as the trade is well ordered in the Delta, and slaves in good supply, so you can reduce waiting time on the coast and the feeding of your Negroes while you're waiting. On this occasion, we had not been a week at sea when these Igbo began to fall into a fixed melancholy. They could not be brought to eat by flogging, and began to die in numbers. I discovered from my linguista that they believed that by dying they would get back to their own country. So what do you think I did, sir?"
Thurzo paused to drink some of his brandy.
"You think I tried persuasion on 'em?" he said.
At this moment there was a light tapping on the cabin door, but at this climactic moment of his story he paid no attention to it.
"I'll tell you what I did, sir. I had the slaves brought up on deck, and in full view of all, I cut off the heads of those who had died with a cleaver from the galley. Who the devil is that knocking? Give him a shout to come in, Barton." "Yes, sir. That is what I did. And do you know why?"
In answer to Barton's summons, the door had been pushed open, and Sullivan stood wild-eyed and dishevelled on the threshold. He was in time to hear his captain's concluding remarks.
"I did it so they might clearly understand that if they were determined to return home, they would have to do so without their heads. I had no more trouble with them from that day forward." "What are you doing here?"
"Begging your pardon, sir." After the first glances, Sullivan kept his eyes down. He had prepared his speech and delivered it without faltering, though rather too fast.
"The captives being in chains, sir, they cannot move their limbs freely to the sound of me fiddle, and the noise they make with the clanking is swamping me notes. There is more than 30 pairs, sir, fastened at wrist and ankle, and all of them jumping. The sound of the chains is drowning out me fiddle entirely."
He paused, looked up briefly, then down again. He had remembered another point.
"And the numbers is increasing all the time," he said. "I'll never be able to hear me own notes, and I'll forget what it is I'm supposed to be playing."
Thurzo turned, frowning, to his first mate.
"Where is this man talking about?" he said. "Is he drunk?"
It was an old, menacing trick of his not to address an underling directly.
"What are you talking about?" Barton demanded. "How dare you come here with this rigmarole talk of fiddling? Don't you know you should have gone through one of the officers?"
As often happened with Sullivan, his initial fear, strong enough to have kept him hesitating long at the door, had diminished now in the warmth and justice of his own advocacy.
"Begging your pardon, sir, but I was asking myself if the chains could be taken off." "Taken off? Just for the period of me playing?"
Sullivan said. Thurzo's brows had drawn together in a ferocious frown. For a few moments he said nothing. Then they saw his mouth move in a curious, grimacing, stretching way, almost convulsive in appearance. He raised his face as if about to sneeze, and a series of hoarse, choking sounds came from somewhere deep in his throat. After a moment or two, the others, regarding him meanwhile in astonished silence, neither of them had any idea to begin with what ailed him, never having seen such symptoms in him before, he took out a capacious handkerchief and wiped his eyes.
"By God, that's rich!" he said. "I haven't heard anything so rich for a long time. Did you hear him, Barton? This gut-scraper wants the chains taken off him because the noise is spoiling his music."
"He must be out of his senses," Barton said blankly. Thurzo turned to Paris, traces of tears still in his eyes.
"Here is another fellow of the same kidney as yourself," he said. "He doesn't know what is the real world either."
Paris looked at the fiddler in silence for a moment. Then he said, without smiling,
"I don't disdain the connection, if he doesn't."
Sullivan was too concerned with bearing himself properly to look the surgeon in the eye, but the grace of these words went to his heart, and he never repeated them to anyone, not even Blair. Everything else he recounted later in the forecastle with considerable embellishment and dramatic license.
"I put me arguments fair and square," he said. "I gave me reasons. Not surprising, they refused me. Thurzo has no feeling for music any more than a toad. If that is the case," I says to them, "you might as well not have employed a fiddler at all," and I turns on me heel.
Under the chaffing attention of his shipmates, his spirits rose. He was by nature mercurial, and he felt sure of McGann's shilling, but the words of kinship, unexpected, unsolicited, as he stood there with his head down and Thurzo's fearsome laughter still in his ears, these were to shine in his memory forever. Soon after midnight, the first of the land breeze began making along the river, and Thurzo ordered sail to be got up and all to be made ready for purchasing anchor. At 2 they weighed and got out to sea, the wind by this time giving a good offing. In the cover of darkness, as quietly as possible, the Liverpool merchant began to steer a course southeastward. But when the ship met the deep sea swell, the rhythm of her movement changed, and the people in the cramped and fetid darkness of the hold, understanding that they had lost all hope of returning to their homes, set up a great cry of desolation and despair that carried over the water to the other ships in the road, and the slaves in the holds of the ships heard it and answered with wild shouts and screams, so that for people lying awake in villages along the shore, and for solitary fishermen up before dawn, there was a period when the night resounded with the echoes of lamentation. Part 6, Chapter 32. It was an uneventful voyage, apart from the attempt of one negro to put an end to his life by severing the veins of his neck with his nails. While dressing the wounds, Paris learned from Jimmy that the man had been falsely convicted of witchcraft and sold to pay his fine.
"Very good way for make money," Jimmy said. "Man got nothing, so they sell him."
They rounded the cape and came to anchor in 11 fathoms, abreast of the river and within sight of the fort. Their approach was saluted with 3 guns, and Thurzo returned the same number. In the afternoon, a company pinnace with 12 oars came out for them, rowed by looser-built, lither men, Paris noted, than the crew boatmen of the grain coast they had just left. Thurzo left the ship in charge of Barton, and he and the surgeon embarked on the pinnace for shore. The town at this distance was a low jumble of native huts, set in a mesh of greenery. Lying to the left of it, on a rocky eminence above the river bank, rose the white fort, shimmering in the sunshine, dramatic and imposing with its block towers and high crenellated walls. Paris made out the Union Jack flying from the battlements, and another flag, blue and white, the colours of the company, Thurzo told him. With astonishing judgment and skill, the oarsmen brought them to shore through the violent paroxysms of the surf. They mounted the slope of the foreshore, past narrow fishing boats curved high at the prow, with tufted fetish bundles tied at their heads. It was hot here, out of the breeze, and the strength of the light troubled Paris's eyes. Screens of nets were drying on poles, and the scraps of fish scales caught in them glinted and flashed. Escorted by the company negroes, they made their way past marshy flats where naked children ran. Flies rose in swarms, geese and ducks pottered in the muddy water. There was a stretch of dead crabs from the river bank and of decaying coconuts that had been half buried in the sand to rot the fibre free. The walls of the fort rose above them with an intensity of white, almost blinding. There was to Paris a terrible strangeness in this great monumental structure amidst the squalid and provisional evidences of life around them. The cluttered, evil-smelling shore, the ramshackle town, the signs everywhere of a collaboration with the forces of nature that was tentative and temporary. The battlemented walls denied all this. They asserted the principle of permanence. There would always be profits to make, interests to defend. In the fertile interior of Africa, her children, her greatest resource, would multiply endlessly and come down in endless procession to be sold below these walls, beside the sea. The way they were following rose more steeply in the last few hundred yards as they approached the rocky bluff on which the fort was built. Then they were in the sharp black shadows of the buttresses, and Paris felt immediate relief from the assaults of heat and light. The heavy gates stood open. The soldiers on sentry duty, one at either side, straightened from their position of ease without coming fully to attention, their tunics dark red in the deep shadow. They were conducted to the governor's quarters, up flights of stone stairs with steps of alternate white and black, freshly painted. On the landing, defending the approach, 2 small brass cannons squatted. Crossed pikes stood on the wall behind. There was a passage and a narrow hallway, also hung with weapons, then finally the door to the governor's chambers. He was there to receive them, a handsome, pale-mouthed man with a high bridge to his nose and a languid, murmuring manner of speech. His shirt was elaborately ruffled with lace at the neck and cuffs, and he wore a short silver wig with curled rolls above the ears.
"Captain Thurzo, Mr. Paris," he said, with minimum effort of the lips. "I'm glad to make your acquaintance. We have not had dealings before, Captain, I believe."
"No, sir."
Bewigged, cocked hat under his arm, in his ceremonial broadcloth, Thurzo looked out of his element here, in the wainscoted room with its several low tables and armless leather chairs. Paris was reminded of their first meeting in Liverpool, with his uncle present, when Thurzo had worn that same look of staring outrage, as if he had been derided. The captain was a fish that could only swim in a certain water.
"I did trade with Mr. Charles Gordon,"
he said now, in his hoarse and lingering fashion. The words seemed forced from the depths by the pressure of some urgent secret, as if only a rage to confide could have steered them up through his windpipe. His confidences, when they came, were not distinguished by tact, however.
In these last years, he said, I've seen three governors come and go, two under the old charter of the Royal Africa Company, and one since the new company took over.
You're a man of much experience, the governor said, moving his almost bloodless lips in the semblance of a smile. Please be seated, gentlemen. Will you take a glass of port, Captain?
Thank you, sir. I will.
And you, Mr. Paris?
I would be content with a little lemon water, something of that kind.
You do not care for port, then?
Not in this heat. Paris's tone was abrupt. Whatever the progress he had made towards humility, he was no better able than before to bear with condescension.
You're right, sir, the governor said. You're a man of sense, I can see. The captain is well seasoned, and I dare say it does him no harm, but I never touch it myself in the middle hours of the day. I have some barley water here. Will that suffice?
Thank you.
Your port, Captain. Gentlemen, good health. I will not join you at present, pray forgive me. What I generally have at this time of afternoon, or just a little later, is a syllabub of cream and thin cider, sweetened with a modicum of honey. I find it answers well. What do you think of such a dish, sir?
Think of it. Paris found himself being regarded closely. For all the nonchalance of the tone, the governor's eyes were fixed on him with a distinct sharpness of interest.
I would think it healthsome and nourishing, he said.
I'm glad to hear you say that, sir. I prepare it myself, with my own hands. To teach my last imbecile of an orderly how to make it in the right proportions took me months, gentlemen, and I cannot tell you what stores of patience. And no sooner was he schooled to it than he succumbed to an ague of some sort that is going round among the troops. I find myself unable to face the prospect of beginning all over again with another, so I do it now myself. The governor paused and appeared to muse some moments, looking down his nose. Yes, he said softly, I find it answers pretty well. It seemed to Paris now that he could hear screams, though he could not tell from where they were coming. Somewhere outside, it seemed.
Charles Gordon, whom you did business with, Captain, was my predecessor here, he heard the governor say in his well-bred, languid tones. He died of a putrid fever. He died in the room next to this one. His predecessor died in this room where we are standing, of a burst blood vessel. But whether we say they died of this or that, they both died of the same thing, gentlemen.
Why? What was that?
Thurzo said with interest. They died through not taking proper care of themselves. Diet is the key to it. Would you not agree as a medical man, Mr. Paris?
I do not know. There are other factors in a climate such as this one. Certainly, diet is important.
The screams were coming from somewhere below them. Paris glanced towards the windows. The drapes were drawn against the strong light. He thought of the flights of stairs they had mounted to come here. The rooms must lie along the ramparts of the fort, facing the afternoon sun.
Yes, I'm sorry, the governor said. He had noticed the surgeon's distraction. There is a private of Marines being flogged. They have chosen just this time to do it, and sounds rise to us here from the courtyard in spite of...
Well, you need not apologize to us, sir, Paris said rather too hastily. Our ears will recover from the discomfort more quickly than will his back.
The governor's eyebrows had risen slightly at this impetuous speech, but when he spoke, his expression had resumed its usual frigid composure.
It was I who ordered him the flogging, he said. He stole a snuff-box from my study and sold it for drink. It was quite clearly proved upon him. I ordered him 100 lashes. The snuff-box was one I set particular store by. It had a sentimental value for me. You will understand my feelings when I tell you that it was a present from a lady.
Paris could not for the moment find a response to this, though it was clear one was expected. The governor had addressed him, not Thurso, no doubt supposing the captain incapable of finer feelings. It was he, the captain, however, who saved the present silence from lengthening awkwardly. Not finding much of interest in this tale of a theft and a flogging, he had been glancing into the corners of the room for some time, and now said,
I believe these chambers have been refurbished since the last occasion I had the honour to be here, and I noticed as we came up that the timber and the ironwork on the gates are new.
Yes, you are right, Captain, the governor said. There have been extensive repairs. The work was begun in the days of my predecessor, and has not been long completed. The company, when it took over the fort from the Royal Africa Company, which, as you know, is now dissolved, finding it dilapidated and in some parts ruinous, thought fit to expend some considerable sums on its reconstruction. They were right to do so, in my view.
This fort is the visible evidence of our presence here. It must be made imposing. We are judged by it, sir. Not only the power and wealth of the company, but that of our whole nation. By their works shall ye know them, as the scriptures say. Competition for trade is increasing all down the coast. We cannot rest on our laurels. The company is very much alive to the importance of the image it presents. The governor lay back in his chair, as if the energy required for this speech had exhausted him. He drew out a square of cambric from his sleeve and dabbed at his temples and the corners of his lips. A scent of lavender expanded in the still air of the room. The screaming had stopped now, but the regular sound of the lash continued. They were obliged to bring craftsmen out. The governor sighed after a moment. All the oak of the interior panelling had to be imported. Imagine the difficulty we were under in getting these wretched people to transport the stone. With their distaste for work of any kind, our labour here was worse than that confronting the pharaohs of old. Well, gentlemen, it grows time for me to busy myself with my syllabub. With your permission, I shall give you over to the care of one of our factors, Mr. Saunders, who will take you down to see the slaves. After that, you might like to take your ease for a while. Saunders will show you your quarters. I look forward to seeing you both again at supper. He rang a small brass handbell that had been lying on the table before him. An African in white tunic and drawers appeared instantly and was told to fetch Mr. Saunders, for whom they waited some minutes in a silence made rather uneasy by Thurso's audible breathing and the governor's total immobility. There was no sound at all from the courtyard below, but it seemed to Paris that he could hear a faint but steady sound of hammering from some more distant source. The governor kept his nose and mouth buried in his handkerchief, though he freed them once to ask the surgeon his opinion of the efficacy of watered spirits in preventing disease. The company doctor here recommended a glass of red wine with the juice of half a lemon and a little sugar as a good defence against contagion, he said. But he died of fever a month ago, leaving me in some doubt of his remedy. The surgeon was seeking to reply to this when there was a knock at the door and Saunders entered. He was youngish, perhaps not more than 30 or so, but sunken-eyed and haggard. With him as their guide, they returned to ground level, and thence through stone-floored passages towards what Paris thought might be the rear of the fort, the side facing away from the sea. But the corridors twisted and turned, and after a while he had lost all sense of direction. As they proceeded, he began to feel a sort of remote terror, the anxiety that comes sometimes in dreams of labyrinths, when each turning threatens to confront us with something intolerable and we struggle to wake before we reach it. What he might meet he did not know. No one can keep account of damage done to himself. We imagine we have absorbed the shock, the harm, but we have merely caged it, and not in a strong cage either. It waits within the bars for a signal, and however long the wait may be, the leap is always unerring. A man can, after 20 years, be struck by a horror he thought he had forgotten, and it will be green and fresh as ever. Often the pounce comes before the mind knows the signal, as it came to Paris now, with the smell of the dank stone, the smell of degradation somewhere ahead of him, a horror almost incredulous that he was lost here, in this place, that he, who had prided himself on his vigilant clarity of mind, and ruined himself for it, could have been his own self-deceiver, could have made his own despair a reason for compounding the misery of the world, and that he could have called this monstrous egotism self-abnegation, and offered it to a dead woman as a proof of love. The dead could only be mourned. Love is for the living, he thought suddenly. And the thought dispelled his fear. A final turn brought them to the slave dungeons, set side by side like cells, with barred fronts and stone walls and high barred windows through which the afternoon sun was falling now in straight rays. He had been right. They were at the rear of the fort, against the outside walls. Three of the dungeons were occupied now, two with men handcuffed together in pairs, and one with unshackled girls and women. Sunlight, for this hour, was caged there with them. Motes of dust moved with gauzy flies through the bright air. The bodies of the slaves were flecked and stippled, and the straw that covered the earth floors was luminous gold. The smells of excrement and trodden straw seemed like a release of this flooding warmth of sunshine. Through the barred embrasures in the walls,
Paris heard the hammering again, much closer now. A double stroke, impatient and swift, metal on wood. Then he saw that one of the women had come forward and was standing pressed against the bars in a shaft of sunlight. She was looking directly at him. He saw the gleam of her eyes. But her face was shadowed. Sunlight fell on her from the window behind. Her face and head were edged with fire. She was naked, but he took in little of her form beyond that she was slender and straight-shouldered. She was somehow protected from closer scrutiny by her stillness, which struck him suddenly as sacramental, and by the edging of fire around her. He looked at her steadily, but she did not look away. He had a moment of slight dizziness, as if he had made some too precipitate movement.
36 in all, Saunders said. We're expecting a batch from up country.
In this stronger light, Paris saw that the factor was younger than he had at first supposed, perhaps not much more than 20, though much wasted by some recent fever.
What is that persistent hammering? He asked.
There has been an outbreak of jail fever among the garrison troops, Saunders said. There are two more dead of it since yesterday. The carpenters are making coffins for the dead. It has not touched the slaves, I'm glad to say.
Shall we get to business? Thurso said. We've had enough talking round the matter.
Away from the oppression of the drawing-room and the governor's presence, he was himself again, in his proper element, with the penned creatures and the bargaining.
Those are never wicker people, those men there, he said, pointing towards a group of tall, very robust negroes. See those heads, Mr. Paris? Look at the limbs of those men. See how they stare back at us? Those are Corrymantee negroes, Mr. Saunders. What are they doing so far west?
There is a story to that, Saunders said, a little uneasily, as it seemed.
I warrant there is.
They were taken from a Dutch slaver returning from Elmina.
Taken? How do you mean? Are you saying the Dutchman was already slaved and they were taken off her?
She wasn't fully slaved. She was still trading. She had about 20 Gold Coast negroes aboard and some ivory and gold dust. She was boarded by natives from King Georgetown. I don't know the details. I believe there were not more than 4 or 5 able-bodied crew on the ship at the time. Some were down with dysentery and some away trading upriver. The blacks came in boats at night and got aboard her. They overpowered the people on deck and carried off the slaves.
And brought them here,
Thurso said with a peculiar intonation.
Yes, that is, they found their way here. As I say, I'm not familiar with the details.
I dare say not. Well, I'm not concerned to inquire too closely. In this business, it is he who possesses the merchandise that has best title to it. And they're fine fellows. Intractable, though, he added quickly. Devilish proud. There are those who will not bid for Corrymantee negroes on any terms. Too much trouble, you know. Still, I'll take them off your hands, subject to our doctor here casting an eye over them. 58 bars is the price I've been trading at. Up at the Sherborough, I'll make it 60 for those Gold Coast men, for the sake of avoiding argument.
The price here is 75 bars, Saunders said, for all male slaves in prime condition, independent of where they hail from, and 68 for women. Expressions of outrage Paris had seen before on the captain's face, but the present one surpassed them all.
75 bars!
The words came in a harsh, incredulous whisper. He turned his body stiffly round towards Paris, his only ally now, however uncongenial.
Did you hear that, Mr. Paris? That is near 25 guineas in coin of the realm. The prices cannot have jumped so high. When Mr. Gordon was company agent here, there was not this difference. He kept the prices prevailing on the coast.
You had best speak to the governor about it, not to me. Saunders looked suddenly very young, despite his emaciation, and distinctly unhappy. No one else has any say. The company sent me out as factor, but I have no more scope than a dog here, and it is a dog's life altogether, sir, so you would do best to inquire of the governor.
I will. Be sure of it, Thurso said grimly. Come, Mr. Paris. There is nothing to be done here for the moment.
However, he had no opportunity at supper, where he found himself seated at some distance from the governor, below the commander of the garrison, a Major Don Levy, and the company treasurer, whose name was Eager, with a young man named Delblanc, described as an artist, on his side, and Paris opposite with 2 silent Swedes beside him, whose names the captain hadn't caught. There were no women at table. Thurzo had already tucked his napkin under his chin and dipped his spoon into the soup when a tall negro in a dark suit and a clerical neckband, who had been introduced as the Reverend Kalabanda, rose to his feet, closed his eyes in the hush, and intoned in a voice of considerable resonance,
"O most merciful Father, we give thee humble thanks for this thy special bounty, beseeching thee to continue thy loving kindness unto us, that our land may yield us her fruits of increase, to thy glory and our comfort, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen."
He resumed his seat in the midst of murmured amens, and addressed himself gravely to his soup.
"Your English is extremely good, Mr. Kalabanda," Paris said, speaking across the table. "I congratulate you on it."
The vicar smiled at Paris's compliments, and the small scars high on his cheeks, which Paris thought might be due to ceremonial cuts, stretched with his smile. He was stout and muscular, his arms and shoulders straining his clerical coat. His eyes were coal black and lustrous, and the skin of his face shone with health.
"I have spent many years in England," he said. "Most of my life. I was at school and at theological college there."
"This man is a credit to his family, Mr. Paris," the governor said in his expiring tones. "He is a living demonstration of what the African is capable of, given sobriety and good governance."
"Aye, damn it, that is the key to the business," the major said loudly, and Paris saw now that he was drunk, and must have been well on the way to it when he arrived among them.
The surgeon caught Delblanc's eye across the table, and smiled a little, and saw the young man's face break into an answering smile of great warmth and humour, though there was a degree of satire in it, too, which he seemed careless to conceal.
"Your people taught me language," the chaplain said. "A great gift, indeed, and I have profited from it to bless the name of God, and that country where, of all others, his laws are respected, which I never cease from doing, day or night. Language, Captain, what a great gift! The word, the logos. God said, 'Let there be light.' Said, sir."
For some reason he had fastened on Thurzo for audience. The captain's great square cage of a face gave little away, but his eyes had retreated as far as possible back into his head.
"I do not allow my wife's vile language to be spoken in my hearing, Captain," the chaplain said. "I do not permit my children to use it. They speak only English."
In an attempt to shake off the Reverend Kalabanda's gaze, Thurzo addressed himself to the major, whose face was lowered over his roast duck and sweet potatoes.
"There has been a fort here for a fair time now, one way or another, sir."
The major raised his head in the abrupt way of the drunken. He gave the impression of being held in place in his chair only by the stiff brocade of his uniform.
"Centuries, sir," he said. "The Portuguese built this fort and held it for 100 years. Then the Dutch took it off them. Then we took it off the Dutch. Then the Danes had a try for it, but naturally they could not prevail against us."
He reached for his wine with deliberate care.
"The French came into it somewhere, too," he said. "I cannot recall exactly where."
He looked with dazed eyes down the table.
"Confusion to the French," he said, raising his glass.
From the head of the table, the governor was still singing the praises of his chaplain.
"He has come back here to preach the gospel in his ancestral lands. His father is Chief Peachy Kalabanda, who is a highly respected figure in these parts."
"Yes," the vicar said. "I have returned to my homeland. I used to run about here as a little child. My father brought me here when he came with slaves to sell. That was in the days of the old company. I used to look up at this great monument, this big white fort. My father used to tell me this was the home of the great white king."
Kalabanda smiled and shook his head at the memory.
"I little thought that one day I would find myself sitting at this table, an ordained priest of the Church of England."
"And so it is his home,"
the governor said. He raised a napkin to dab at his pale lips as if to remove pollutant traces.
"Wherever the flag is planted, there is his home."
"I hope he ain't going about baptizing among the slaves,"
Thurzo muttered hoarsely in Paris's ear.
"It makes him uppish. You persuade a negro he has a soul to be saved, and he will be a source of trouble forever afterwards, to himself and to his owner."
It is possible that the chaplain's ears were keen enough to hear something of this, for he smiled again and said,
I minister among the troops here and among my free brethren. That there are those who are not free helps me in my ministry. The mind is constituted to accept the God of the more powerful. This we must accept as human nature, and our human nature is given to us by God, so God himself has endowed